Sean Pesch is the founder and chief investment officer at Ranmore. He's been warning us, waving flags about the US markets in particular at the BizNews Investment Conference in September. He had some pretty strong things to say, and we're going to be finding out from him how he feels about the way that the markets have performed, well, not performed in the past week. You remember, Sean, the Roadrunner, Beep Beep the Roadrunner cartoons, and there was a Wile E. Coyote who used to run over cliffs, and then his legs would go like crazy, and of course, he would then fall down. Are stock markets in the world having a Wile E. Coyote moment? In other words, they're over the cliff, people are still not quite realizing where they are. Their legs are still running pretty quickly, but in a moment, they're going to have that cartoon moment of crashing down.
Alec, some markets, mainly the US, I would argue. I think that's absolutely right, unfortunately. And I think what you saw yesterday was a stunning reversal. I mean, stunning in terms of profound. You know, we had NVIDIA's news. The numbers on the face of it looked good. Everyone's been talking about this AI bubble. NVIDIA's up after hours. The US gaps up. The NASDAQ gaps up and ends down. And there was a massive turnaround. Now, technically, that is very bad news because when markets start falling on supposedly good news, it's not a good sign.
When you say technically, just unpack it for people who are not that close to investment world.
So price action, you know, technical analysis is price action, the analysis of price action. And that is really, you know, I mean, who makes these prices? They're humans. It's behavioral investing. You know, so it's one thing having the numbers and the PE ratios and all the rest, but there's a psychology behind it too, which, you know, we think it's quite important to understand. And so when you have a situation, I guess it's logical when you think about it, when you have a situation when there's supposedly really good news and things go down, what does that tell you? It tells you everybody's bought. The last buyer has bought. Okay. When things go up and, on supposedly bad news, means it tells you it's all in the price, you know? So that's what happened yesterday. And it's quite concerning. But mainly for the US. And I think what's interesting, you know, like when you look at, you know, that the S&P 500, there are 30 markets ahead of the S&P 500 year to date. And the S&P in euros or Swiss francs is flat. Now, if you're a German, wealthy German investor and you've taken your wealth manager's taken the money and put it in the US, you know, and you're looking at the DAX and the DAX is up 22% in euros and the S&P is flat. When you've had Trump and the deregulation promises and the, you know, AI boom and you flat. So I think we got to think about that, you know. So the S&P in sterling is up 6%, but the FTSE in sterling is up 17%. I mean, look at the JSE, same story. So, you know, it's in the price.
Is this telling us that the American stock markets are now being held up by hot air or what?
In many cases, you know, I mean, NVIDIA's results were great, 63% revenue growth, 60% EPS growth, great. But it's on a 1.8% free cash flow yield. And you know, who's going to stick their money in the bank? You're not even getting that free cash flow in the form of dividends.
So what does that mean?
It means that if you put your money in if you buy a NVIDIA and they paid out all their cash flow to you as dividends, you get 1.8%. Okay.
But they're not paying out.
If they did, but they're not paying out your money in free cash flow. So, you know, so, and they're using a whole bunch of that free cash flow to buy back shares from employees that they've given them to. So the point being, it's very expensive. And if you go back in time and look at when the Japanese market, which was the biggest in the world index back in the late 80s, it was on 50 times earnings. Now people are saying, no, but it's not the US is not on 50 times earnings. No, it's on 50 times cash flow because CapEx is much higher than depreciation. Okay. So the cash flow, I think the cash flow numbers are important. And what people are now asking about is they're going, well, everyone's depreciating these NVIDIA chips at different rates. But this company over here depreciating it over 3 years. This one over here using 6 years. So what is the rate we should be using? How long do these chips last? You know, so maybe cash flow is a safer bet. Well, these things are on 50 times cash flow. And you don't get rich buying stuff on 50 times cash flow, generally speaking.
Okay. But this week, Warren Buffett bought Alphabet. And you have Alphabet in your portfolio.
No, so we don't have Alphabet in our portfolio anymore. We bought it at the beginning of the year. But, you know, when it's up 35-40%, we sold it. And we were hoping that the CapEx was going to fall. The CapEx didn't fall. But it's been a great company. But, look, Warren stepped back. You know, the new guys have taken over. And that's the only company that is up after earnings, or the only one of the large Mag 7. If you look at all the others, all had great third quarter numbers, they're all down. So because everyone owns them, you know, they're massive in the world, massive in the S&P. The S&P is massive in the world index. Every investor from Korea to Japan to Europe, everyone owns these things. Okay. So the problem is when the herd changes direction, and you're in the herd, running with the herd, you could get trampled. And I think that's what's going on there. You know, so.
Cody from Paul has sold multiple vehicles to We Buy Cars. Suspicious? I think so.
Is that a crime?
No. Where are you getting the cars?
I buy them and I sell them at the spot, like a normal person.
Okay.
No, man, I'm just an accounting student. I know a good deal when I see one.
That's Excel meant.
What's more stressful, tax season or selling a car at We Buy Cars?
Tax season, obviously.
We Buy Cars, the easiest way to sell your car by far.
What about that Trump trade? Towards the end of last year, there was a real, they called it the Trump bump. And then we had the Trump always chickens out, the taco trade on top of it. So it seems like the guys in the investment markets, they like to make up these anagrams to describe Donald Trump. But you lost out on that because you weren't in on the Trump bump. But by not being involved there, if you look a year on, his presidency has actually been good for stocks or not so good for stocks when you look back now?
Not in euros, not in other currencies. You know, I mean, as I said, there are 30 markets ahead of it. And if you think about it, you know, here's the guy, and I made this point, took a bit of heat on my Bitcoin comments at the last Biz News thing, but I made the point that all this good news, you've got a president who's, you know, hugely behind Bitcoin, you've got all these Bitcoin treasury companies. I mean, Bitcoin's down 14% year to date in dollars. It's down 24% in euros. You know, MicroStrategy is down 55% over the last year. And then you've got all these 2x ETFs. I mean, the 2x MicroStrategy ETFs down 50% this month. So there's a lot of pain out there. And I think this Trump bump, I think it's in the price. And I think there's downside. There's downside for those stocks. But it's potentially, Alec, potentially, I think there's a scenario. In the past, what's happened is when the US falls, every market falls. Okay. I think there's a real case to be made for the fact that because the US is so concentrated, if the US falls, yes, some of these other markets might fall temporarily. But when people are selling US stocks and raising cash, okay, and the dust settles, they're not going back to the US. That marginal dollar is getting invested outside the US. So I think there's a case to be made for US falling and other markets actually going up because money will be diverted to those markets and those markets are less liquid. So the money flows that moves into those markets will have a greater impact on the price.
The JSE, one of those beneficiaries?
I mean, JSE's done well with gold and platinum. I probably not. I don't know. I mean, I would not guess that that's first top of mind. You know, if people are going to go, okay, well, let's take money out of the US, let's put it into Europe because, you know, or Asia. I mean, you've seen Hong Kong and Japan are doing well and all the rest. So, yeah, probably not. Top of mind, I would think, for most investors out there.
So what are your anti-bubble bets? Presuming that we're in that Wile E. Coyote moment of him just about to fall on his bum, where would you be switching your money to quickly now?
Well, Alec, you know, we don't really, we're not out there, we don't care about benchmarks, okay? That's the first thing. So there's huge focus on benchmarks now because it's been hard to beat the benchmark and so everyone just sticks to the benchmark, but we don't care about benchmarks. We only buy companies that we think make sound financial sense and offer a real opportunity of generating a real return. Okay. And so So we've got, businesses that, for example, in last month's fact sheet, something I wrote about Hire, which is a Hong Kong listed. It's one of the largest, white good manufacturers, you know, washing machines and dishwashers and fridges and things like that. I mean, their air conditioning business is growing 30%. You know, they have doubled their amount of money they're spending in R&D over the last, 5-6 years. Whirlpool's has reduced. Okay. And you get more bang for buck on R&D expenditure in China than you do in the US. They've got washing machines that can take the normal size washing machines that can take 13.5 kilograms of washing. Normal one takes 6. Means, you know, so they all, there's this kind of stuff. This is a great business. One of the world leaders on 10 times earnings. You know, so there are these other opportunities out there that just don't make the headlines. Everyone thinks the only place you can make money is in AI. You've got, there's a little business here in the UK called Greggs. So, you know, which is, it's a great value proposition. It's basically like a pastry bakery type chain. Their coffee's half the price of Starbucks and Costco. You know, it's a 4.5% dividend yield. They're growing, revenue at about 7% per annum. There's a huge run rate. You know, they've just got a slightly different business model. So they don't have as many employees. They use more technology. So they're these great growing businesses at attractive prices that have fallen out of favor. But you've got to hunt for them.
At the BizNews conference in September, you used a rather controversial comparison between the US and China, saying that it's sharing some of the same signs that made China uninvestable. Things like excessive compensation, government debt, and unpredictable governance, and so on. Are you of the opinion that this has got worse since September?
Probably no worse. I mean, I don't think it's great. You know, you've got we've had this government shutdown. There's no economic data coming out of the US, or there's less economic data. Trump's out there. You know, are they going to want to take stakes in defense businesses? You know, they've taken stakes in Intel. They've swapped grants in Intel. The government interference in businesses. Look at this whole Medicaid thing and interfering in how these businesses are doing and taking percentage of revenue from NVIDIA. It's not good. And so when, you know, there are many people we know some clients who haven't invested with us because we've got Hong Kong listed stocks, and they say, no, China's uninvestable. And you ask them why, the reasons they get, why do you think that? We don't think that's the case. Why do you think that? They go, well, it's all this government interference. I mean, where's China changed the rules recently? I can't think of an instance where it's recently changed the rules or anything. If anything, they're on the side of their technology companies out there. You know, Alibaba and Baidu. And yeah, there was a time when they were squeezing them a little bit to make sure that that they were paying employees fairly with ride sharing and food delivery and things like that. That's not a bad thing. But I think you've got excessive interference, excessive family benefiting from government contracts in the US. That's not good. And that deserves a discount. And right now there's no discount.
It's a good point that Donald Trump's sons have become super wealthy, and it's almost like there's a blind eye turned towards that. Is that telling you anything about the end of the empire?
I think so. I mean, was it Harry Truman who said, show me a president who's made money as a president, I'll show you a crook. You know? So, I think it's the end of empire, because the rest of the world's looking elsewhere. You know, even Canada. Canada, the Canadians are not buying American products. They're taking American wine. And actually, I was talking when I was in South Africa recently, I was talking to some guys who, you know, own wine farms. They were telling me at a recent expo, okay, of showcasing South African wines, 50% of the buyers were from Canada, because they don't want to drink American Cabernet Sauvignon. They're going to drink Stellenbosch Cabernet Sauvignon, French Cabernet Sauvignon, Robertson. They're not leave a region, ask you. People get grumpy with me, but so that's actually an opportunity for us. It's an opportunity, rather, if India is not buying citrus from the States. Well, it's great. It's an opportunity for us to sell citrus there. And so, you know, you've seen China's exports go up, even though they've fallen to the US. The rest of the world's making a plan, going, we're not going to deal with those guys. Keep changing the rules. We'll deal with different people.
We often see this being discussed in South Africa, and there's a portion of the population who say, no, that's crazy. America's still the biggest economy in the world. You've got to deal with America. You can't not engage with them. But we get increasingly from Pretoria to say, hang on, these are not logical and rational people to deal with. We should be looking elsewhere. Now, you have a rational mind. You are an investor. Your game is all about keep emotions out of it. So are you reading that what Pretoria, or the angle that Pretoria is following, is actually a sensible one, or are we out of step?
No, I think it's a sensible one. I mean, even here in Europe, we tolerate them. I think the politicians are tolerating America, okay? They're looking elsewhere. We know that we cannot no longer rely on America. I mean, you know, look at this. Look at how they've been dealing with supporting Ukraine. Are they going to give us tomahawks to stop Russia, or they're not going to give us tomahawks to keep changing the rules? So the rest of the world, while this Trump administration is in power and it's going to be for another few years, okay, the rest of the world's going to make a plan, and we're going to, they no longer rely. We're not buying defense. We're not buying airplanes. Who was it recently who's buying a whole lot of planes from France? They're not buying US planes, because then the US is interfering and saying, no, you can't use those missiles against Russia. So I think they're becoming less dependable. And as investors, that's also true. You know, I think they're becoming less dependable.
And I guess companies as well, companies that are less dependable are companies that you will quietly switch away from. If you go to a supermarket, for instance, as has happened to many people who went into Pick and Pay for years, and it wasn't as good as it was in the past, they don't send letters to the store manager. They simply see whether Woolies or Checkers or another spa is a better option, and in time leave. Is it similar to what you're perceiving is happening around the world?
I think so, Alec. I think so. You know, there are going to be fewer US fighter jets bought. Okay, they're buying them from Sweden, Gripen. They're buying them from France, etc. Europe. I mean, that's why the defense sector in Europe is doing well, because we're going to support our own defense sector that we can rely on. We're going to be entering into long-term contracts with European companies that we can rely on. We can't rely on America to step up when we need it. We could, but the game's changed. And so I think that's happening not just in that sector. And you're going to see that play out. And so, you know, the guys who say, well, you got to rely on the US, that's the past. I mean, you know, well, let's wean ourselves off the US and find other markets to trade with.
So what's the message for South Africa?
Well, that's it. Well, that's, you know, the other markets, it's going to take time. And so we got to tolerate them, but don't hit your, you know, to the wagon of America, I would suggest. Because look how they're treating us as well. They don't want to send anybody to the G20. And, you know, well, there are lots of people out there. We don't have to be friends with those guys. Yes, they've been big and important in the past, but they're not the only buyer in town.
Let's move on to something very different that I'm quite keen to get your thoughts on. With artificial intelligence nowadays writing a lot of the financial reports, and we know that for a fact. I actually was reading Klaus Schwab from the WEF, his latest book, and he said he used AI to put his book together. He said with the help of AI, but it's now accepted practice. You can bring artificial intelligence in and use it in to assist at the very least. But in some instances, you can be pretty sure it's more than that. Now, you've always been someone who said, I'd rather just work with the numbers. I'll check the numbers, and if the numbers tell me what's happening, I will work with that. I would rather not meet with management. Are you changing your mind now, given that those numbers themselves might be massaged a little bit more, not a little, a lot more than in the past, and indeed, sometimes eyeballing a manager or an executive might be the only way to really find out where they are?
No, I don't think so. We're not changing our way. I mean, the numbers are the numbers. The cash balance is the cash balance. You know, we analyze the cash flow statements very closely and balance sheets. And if things like goodwill are going up unexplainedly, you know, that's a red flag. And things like, you know, unconsolidated subsidiaries, well, we pay close attention to those. You know, those are the kinds of things that led to the unwinding of Steinhoff. So no change in that, Alec. I mean, I think one of the interesting things is as more content is produced by AI, when you are training these large language models, you know, in the past, they were being trained on content which was, you know, original. Now, as more and more of the content becomes AI driven, are you training it on AI? Is it a circular reference? Are you training it on, is becoming less reliable because more of the stuff it's being trained on is AI generated? I think that's a real issue. Does that make sense?
If you want to protect yourself against the Magnificent Seven, as you have done, which are the stocks that you would be investing in now? What are your big bets?
Well, yeah, I mean, we don't take big bets because the future's uncertain. And so we don't pay too much for the future. You know, that comes back to value investing. And I'm pleased to say value investing is doing better than growth investing this month. I think it'd be down, the value sector's down 1.9, growth's down 5.8. So Alec, we don't take big bets. And we don't have to, because as a global fund, we've got the choice of lots of companies out there. But some of the companies that are on our top 10, I mentioned, like Greggs and Hire and companies like EasyJet. You know, those kinds of companies where the oil price is lower, you know, they're well run. In the past, airlines were considered terrible businesses, okay, because high fixed costs, et cetera. But technology has actually improved those businesses. You know, you'll know from when you're looking at flight tickets, when you're trying to buy your ticket, you know, the pricing is dynamic based on demand. And if everybody's trying to buy tickets, you know, ticket prices, the computer knows when school holidays are, when there's a rugby game in Ireland based on demand for those tickets. And so those ticket prices variable. And so those airlines squeeze every last dollar or pound or rand or whatever out of those ticket prices. So I think technology is helping those things. Technology is also changing the landscape for other businesses like consumer brands companies, because you can advertise via Instagram and YouTube and all the rest. You don't have to advertise on television like you did in the past. So you've got to think about the business, not just, oh, well, it was a good business, it's always going to be a good business. And not just, oh, well, it's always been a terrible business, therefore it's always going to be a terrible business. You've got to think about it in dynamic terms and how technology can improve it.
Fascinating always is to speak with you, Sean, but let's end off with something very different. Helpmore. Ranmore is your company. Now you've got something called Helpmore. And I was having a look at the website, and it is a very interesting approach that you're taking here towards charity, towards helping others or giving people a hand up, not going the traditional route of having some guy in the executive who just allocates part of the budget to it. But in fact, you, as the founder of Ranmore, going out yourself and specifically finding smaller charities, smaller organizations that won't be media savvy, that won't be able to get into the boardrooms of major corporates, and as a result, don't really get that well supported. It's I suppose, classic Ranmore and classic Sean Pesh, but unpack it for us.
Yeah, thanks, Alec. You know, I have to, you know, credit BizNews for this, because in September 22, when I was at when you kindly invited me to Champagne Sports, we had $50 million. It was basically our low point, okay? And I said that when we got above $200 million, we'd set up a charity. And so that happened last year. And we started building a team in the background, because I've got to stay focused on the fund, okay? So we've now got a team of people. And initially, we started helping a few charities. You know, how do we find these guys? We'd speak to Kim Finketz, who I met at BizNews, and she told us about a few Eastern Cape charities and all the rest. And we thought, okay, well, we can help these guys, give them some stay in business money. But also LinkedIn, for example, has been, you know, fundamental to the growth of our business. And so when we started seeing some of these charities, well, have you got a LinkedIn profile? You haven't got a LinkedIn profile. So no, we got a Facebook page. We go, well, yeah, but businesses block Facebook. We need to get you a LinkedIn profile. So we started initially with a consultant, a LinkedIn consultant, paid for them to get some help. But now actually we've employed a couple of people in South Africa who are social media people. We're looking at employing a website person to help these businesses. Because what we found is that many of them, they're just doing their amazing stuff. They're saving abandoned children, or they're looking after children after school. And that's what they want to focus on. They don't want to be website developers. They don't want to be LinkedIn specialists. So we'll take that off them. Okay. But then I came along the journey, I suddenly had the penny dropped. And the penny that dropped was that small businesses, you know, talk to any economist out there, small businesses generate jobs and economic growth. Small charities do too. I mean, in many cases, these people are entrepreneurs. They've spotted a need and they're fulfilling the need. Okay. They're meeting the need. They're just not doing it for profit. They're doing it to help. And so, you know, there's King's Home and Cinsa. It's got 20 employees. And those people buy stuff from the local community and they buy food from the local wholesalers and they spend it, et cetera, et cetera. So then I started doing some work. And in the UK, there's 170,000 charities and they employ 3% of the workforce, 1 million people. It's the second largest employer after supermarkets. Okay. And in South Africa, there's 60,000 public benefit organizations. And you go, well, hang on, South Africa, it's a developing country. I mean, the UK, it's developed and you've got 170,000. Like, how can this be? But in the UK, we've got this thing called the Charity Commission. And they are incredibly on it. Okay. They're brilliant. And you can go and search the charity website. You can search based on whatever you want to give to. They make sure their annual report's there. They make sure people are acting in accordance with their constitutions, etc. They're really on it. And when I speak to people in South Africa, the view I've encountered, and maybe this is just a narrow sample, but people are like, you know, I don't know these organizations. And how do I know the money's being spent right? And what about corruption? We know we've grown up in an environment of government being corrupt. So we're distrustful in that regard. So we then came across and we thought, well, hang on a second. How can we help develop trust in a sector so that people can give with some confidence? And we started this thing called the Help More Trust Index. Okay. And we're building a list of charities that we think public can have some confidence in. Now, my team doesn't have the resources to do due diligence of thousands of charities. But if you think about it, we asked Kim van Ketz, you know, Kim, tell us about the charity. She'd been there. She'd seen the people. She knew they were doing good work. You told us about Mummy up in Caledon. You know, you'd seen the line of food. You'd seen them serving the food in the line of people, 200 people. You know, you did the due diligence. So we're going, well, hang on. There are all these people out there who in their communities know of the good people and the kind people. Why don't we invite them to do it? So if you go to our website, helpmorecharity.com, you can propose a charity. Okay. Propose a charity. Say, right, here we go. Alex says, you know, go and support the school in Hermanus. Here's and just give us a couple of things. You know, if you've been there and seen it and give us the NPC number or the charity number, you've kicked a couple of tires. We'll do a little bit of due diligence background, make sure the key people, you know, are put them through a database, et cetera. And let's build up this database of people. So people can then say, well, I want to help a rugby charity or whatever. Because Alec, the need is so real. It's unbelievable. There's a rugby club in Maritzburg we're helping at the moment. Okay, we just started helping. They share rugby boots. Okay. They don't all have, we're rugby world champions. And in the Western Cape, we've got rugby teams sharing boots. It's mind blowing. You know, in Villiersdorp, we gave some sporting equipment to some schools. One school's got 1,000 pupils. They've got one rugby ball. You know, this rugby club in Maritzburg, the one thing we're doing is building a wall next to the clubhouse because there's bullet holes in the clubhouse because they're in the line of fire. The need is unbelievable. Okay. So then I stand back and I go, there's 300,000 SAFRs apparently in the UK. I look at Twickenham and I think they're more than 300,000, but let's run with 300,000. If we each just sacrifice the cost of two coffees from Starbucks a month or 1.5 pints, £10, that's £3 million a month. That's 70 million rand. That's nearly R1 billion a year into small charities. Okay. Now, what about the 100,000 SAFRs in Dubai and the 200,000 in Australia and even all the guys locally? You know, we all want to wear Springbok rugby jerseys. Well, let's make a donation back to the country that, you know, gives us the right to do that. And if you start putting all these billions together and we start putting that money into small charities that are generating jobs, you know, it's going to move the needle. And I look at my mum, you know, she's in a retirement complex. Now, she's not going to start a business. She's not going to start creating jobs, but she can give to charities that sustain and create jobs. And I think it can really move the needle. And it's really, you know, if you read Warren Buffett's farewell letter, there's a sentence in there. He says, when you help someone in any thousands of ways, you help the world. And I think we want to do that.
Sean Pesch, the founder and CIO of Ranmore. And I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.